Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Those distracting digital billboards reconsidered in light of the Boston bombings. A credit card company preaches mindful spending. And why a private equity mogul wants to send our best and brightest to China. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is the Marketplace podcast for Monday, April 22nd. I'm Sarah Gardner in for Kai Ryssdal. Thanks for joining us. Last week's fast-moving events in Boston are now giving way to the more deliberate pace of the American legal system. The 19-year-old suspect accused in the Boston Marathon bombings was arraigned in his hospital room today. Jakar Tsarnaev was charged with using a weapon of mass destruction and malicious destruction of property resulting in death. Bostonians, of course, played a big part in last week's manhunt. And one of the most effective ways the FBI communicated with residents was through messages on giant digital billboards, the same kind of billboards that were just outlawed in Los Angeles. Opponents argued they were distracting to drivers and obnoxiously bright to homeowners who live near them. So, are they a public nuisance or a public service? Marketplace's David Weinberg reports.
The digital billboards around Boston displayed messages that said two explosions at marathon finish. Meanwhile, 3,000 miles across the country in Los Angeles, Dennis Hathaway noticed that the digital billboard near his house wasn't working.
I walk my dog every morning, and I walk by that billboard at 7 o'clock in the morning, and it was dark.
Hathaway wasn't surprised that the billboard had been shut off, and in fact, he was quite happy about it. He's the president of a nonprofit called Ban Billboard Blight, which has been fighting to have many of the city's digital billboards removed.
The billboards themselves went up, you know, without any notice to surrounding property owners. They shined in people's windows. They were in places where intersections where there were a lot of traffic, pedestrian and motorist traffic.
Hathaway says his organization is not opposed to digital billboards.
Our organization believes that digital billboards should be confined to special sign districts.
Like commercial or industrial areas, not residential neighborhoods. This same battle is being waged between outdoor advertising companies and the public in cities across the country. Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel recently proposed a plan to approve 30 digital billboards, which he says will bring in $15 million to the city. Durham, North Carolina has a ban on all digital billboards. And in New Jersey, a judge recently struck down a digital billboard ban.
The federal government, as is represented by the Federal Highway Administration, put out guidance in 2007.
Ken Klein is with the Outdoor Advertising Association of America. Ultimately, the Highway Administration left it up to states to decide how to regulate digital billboards. But it did make recommendations. The signs should not be placed in areas that would compromise public safety. They should not be unreasonably bright, and each image should be displayed for 8 seconds.
So the attraction for that advertiser is the speed, the flexibility, the ability to change the message as often as necessary.
Those are the same attributes that make billboards useful tools for law enforcement. Since 2007, the FBI has had a partnership with the digital billboard company Clear Channel that allows them to post Amber Alerts and, as they did during Thursday's manhunt, display photos of the Boston bombing suspects. The FBI says that digital billboards have led to the apprehension of 51 fugitives in those 6 years, a number that outdoor ad companies will likely cite as they continue to lobby local governments. I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
Talk about lobbying. There was a lot of that going on over a bill on the Senate's agenda today. They're debating whether to give states the authority to collect taxes on all internet sales. And the bill is pitting two web titans against each other, Amazon and eBay. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has that story.
eBay has taken the lead against internet sales tax legislation. Over the weekend, it sent an email out to its merchants, trying to rally them against the bill. Right now, the Senate bill exempts online businesses with less than $1 million a year in sales outside of their home states. eBay wants to expand the exemption to $10 million. eBay Vice President Todd Cohen has spearheaded the online tax fight.
We are committed to working for small businesses and not just have the giant retailers like Amazon use their size advantages against small guys.
Small guys like Chris Chapman. He owns an online business that sells used skis and snowboards on eBay and Amazon. Cohen has just over $1 million in sales every year. He says if he had to charge taxes for all 50 states, he'd have to hire someone just to handle taxes. He says in his dozen years in business, the tax debate is one of his biggest challenges.
Of all the things for 12 years, this one scares me more than anything, because this could be crushing.
Chapman says by supporting the online taxation bill, Amazon is trying to crush him. Amazon wouldn't talk to me for this story, but I did talk with Sucharita Moparu of Forrester Research. She says Amazon is supporting the Senate bill because it's going to be hit with sales taxes anyway. Online retailers have to pay the taxes if they have a physical presence in a state. And Moparu says Amazon is thinking about a major warehouse expansion as part of a same-day delivery plan.
How do you get to same-day delivery? Well, you get to same-day delivery when you have a whole bunch of warehouses all over the U.S.
Well, Prue says Amazon may also be planning to build actual stores someday, which would definitely be collecting sales tax. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Now to a story about Twitter. Remember when it started and people wondered if anybody could say anything important in 140 characters or less? Well, a half a billion users later, Twitter's got a new challenge for us. Try to tell a joke in 6 seconds or less. Shannon Mullen reports on Twitter's team up with one of the biggest brands in comedy.
As if it's not hard enough to be funny when you've got a whole stand-up routine. Next week, Comedy Central's comedians will spend 5 days telling jokes in tweets and super short videos made with Twitter's new Vine app.
Well, thankfully, I'm not the one who has to make the jokes.
Walter Levitt is Executive Vice President of Marketing for Comedy Central.
Twitter really has, over the last couple of years, become a terrific social platform for comedians and for comedy, and it just seemed like an absolute logical place for us to try something new and innovative.
For Twitter, it's not about making media, but giving partners a place to put theirs and attracting the built-in fan base. The company bought Vine last fall and just launched a music discovery app.
Well, Twitter has rolled out a strategy of expanding beyond 140 characters.
Richard Greenfield is a media analyst for BTIG Research.
High-quality content from brands like Comedy Central is a great way to introduce new people who have not tried Twitter to use it.
From a cost perspective, the content will come cheap for both Twitter and Comedy Central, says media analyst Zachary Rees-Davis with Forrester Research.
Compared to producing a full television show, Comedy Central doesn't have to invest that much resources in it in order to see, will this work?
Think six-second comedy sounds impossible? Check out day two of the Twitter Fest when some of the pros plan to prove otherwise. I'm Shannon Mullen for Marketplace.
Okay, I'll take a stab at it. Why did God create stock analysts? In order to make weather forecasters look good. Okay, all right, we'll leave it to the pros, I think. Stock market details coming up when we do the numbers. So what can $300 million buy you in China? Perhaps the Chinese version of the Rhodes Scholarship. That's what China and American private equity mogul Stephen Schwarzman are hoping. Schwarzman's doling out $100 million of his own money and raising another $200 million to set up an international scholarship program at a top Chinese university. 200 students a year studying for a master's degree in Beijing. Marketplace's Rob Schmitz joins us now from China. Hi, Rob.
Hi, Sarah.
So apparently China approached Mr. Schwarzman about this scholarship. It wasn't the other way around. Why is China so eager to establish this kind of program?
Well, I think this scholarship for China is a soft power coup. Hundreds of elite students each year from the U.S. and all over the world will spend a year at Tsinghua, which is one of China's top universities. They'll rub elbows with, you know, China's best students and professors. For years now, China's government has exported this type of influence. But in the case of Schwarzman's scholarship, if you're the Chinese Communist Party, the students you want to reach will now be coming to you. So here we have soft power and influence, as the case has been with manufactured goods. Instead of being a net exporter, China is now working on being a net importer.
What do you think Mr. Schwarzman and his private equity group Blackstone get out of all of this?
Well, this is China. Apart from setting up one of the largest single scholarships ever, which will be competing with the Rhodes Scholarship for prestige, I think it's important to look at who Stephen Schwarzman is. He's spent his career, as you mentioned, as a private equity tycoon, and nowhere on earth is private equity growing as fast as it is in China. If you take a look at who's donating money to this scholarship, it's basically a who's who of U.S. companies doing business here. You've got Boeing, Caterpillar, J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, the list goes on. All of these companies do big business in China. All of them depend on smooth connections with China's Communist Party to do that business. This is definitely a good business for everyone involved.
So getting down to the program itself, who's going to be participating in this, and what kind of experience are these scholars going to get? Are they going to get the experience of the real China, do you think, Rob?
No. The program plans to take in 10,000 students over the next 50 years. Nearly half of them will be from the U.S., a fifth will be actually from China, and the rest will be from Australia, the EU, Latin America. For those students who are eligible, it appears this will be an elite group. They'll be the best students from all over the world, mixing with the best students from all over China. Basically, an opportunity for many of these elite students from the world's largest economies to get to know each other and to get to know at least Beijing. And the other interesting element of the scholarship here is that all the instruction at Tsinghua University for these students will be in English. Students can take a summer session where they learn a little Chinese, but Chinese fluency isn't required. And with just a summer session of language study, I think it's safe to assume that many of these students will go through a year in Beijing without really being able to communicate in a local language. So the emphasis here seems to be more on schmoozing with other elite students in China, getting to know the country a little, but not really getting to know the culture or the language too deeply.
You know, Rob, when Mr. Schwarzman was asked about this program, he was quoted as saying, "I think most Americans know nothing about China." Is that a fair statement, do you think?
I think that's a bit harsh. I think he's probably right. But I'd say the opposite is also true. Most mainland Chinese who've never left their country, have never had the opportunity to leave, know very little about America as well. So, you know, programs like this can help bridge that gap in understanding.
Rob Schmitz, Marketplace's China Bureau Chief. Thanks a lot, Rob.
Thanks a lot, Sarah.
And now let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 19 points, or 0.1%, to close at 14,567. The NASDAQ added 27 points, or 0.8%, to finish at 3233. And the S&P 500 put on 7 points, almost 0.5%, to end at 1562. Halliburton energized by 5.5% after its first quarter earnings beat forecasts. Caterpillar's profits fell short of expectations, but its stock still pushed up nearly 3% on predictions of production growth in China next quarter. Netflix was up 19% in after-hours trading after reporting strong profits after the bell. Tokyo's Nikkei index added nearly 2%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.69%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on sales of new homes for the month of March. The Senate Commerce, Science, and Transportation Committee holds a hearing on challenges and opportunities for human space exploration. And with mirth and laughter, let old wrinkles come. William Shakespeare died on April 23rd, 1616. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Sarah Gardner in for Kai Rizdal. The U.S. Army's Rapid Equipping Force, REF for short, is a little-known agency making big changes in how soldiers fight. It was created after an officer saw a video of soldiers trying to clear an Afghan cave with a rope and a grappling hook. Why not robots, he wondered. That was 10 years ago, and since then, REF has become an innovator in many fields, including energy. From Burn, an energy journal, here's Alex Chadwick.
The great military book is from early China, The Art of War. There is no art of basic soldiering. You heavy up, you go for a walk, you look for trouble for a few hours or days.
Pick up, let's go.
This is a YouTube video. There are many. A U.S. Army unit walking patrol in Afghanistan.
The average weight on a soldier's back is somewhere around 104 pounds.
Colonel Pete Newell, U.S. Army. Soldiering doesn't change. Technology does.
27 of it is batteries.
Colonel Newell is the director of the Rapid Equipping Force, REF, a think tank, hardware store, tech lab for combat soldiers. A perfect solution to a soldier problem, a Humvee redesigned against IEDs, for instance, might take years. REF tries to find pretty good answers that already exist or are about to exist.
What we'll describe is find the first, best, fastest solution we can.
Here's an example, something REF helped develop to answer a soldier problem with, again, IEDs. And if you wonder what all those batteries are for, well...
It is called a Thor 3.
Thor? It sounds heavy.
The piece of equipment itself weighs 25 pounds. Over a three-day patrol, a platoon of 28 soldiers will have three of these systems because of the bands that they operate at.
Thor is a jammer, a signal jammer. Everybody adapts technology, including the people trying to kill us. A favorite tactic? A hidden bomb with a cell phone trigger. Wait for the soldiers to get close, call the number, boom. If you're going out on patrol for 3 days, you want a Thor 3, batteries included. If Thor is working, the bomb triggers will not.
The battery total for that 72 hours is 238 pounds. So 238 pounds distributed across 28 bodies on top of the weight for the system and the weight of all the other stuff they're carrying.
Colonel Newell is a former brigade commander, awarded a Silver Star and unit commendation for leadership at Fallujah, the biggest fight in Iraq. He knows soldiering. But when he took over REF 3 years ago, he didn't think about energy.
I would tell you that I really did not see that as a major task for the Rapid Equipment Force.
But combat outposts, remote battlefield camps for 20 to 150 soldiers, use a lot of diesel fuel. The convoys to supply them are magnets for bombs and snipers. They're the Army's single greatest vulnerability in Afghanistan. Energy. And it's true for a single soldier heavied up in walking patrol. The Thor 3 is a REF solution. It's too heavy, it's too power hungry, but it works right now with existing tech until they design something better. Still, in January, at REF headquarters at Fort Belvoir outside Washington, the colonel was more excited by something else.
These are solar recharging blankets. I mean, this is a 10-watt blanket, and it's 2 feet by 3 feet, the size of a poster.
It folds neatly. It weighs 12 ounces. It comes in camo. Its 10 watts of power are enough to fully charge two smartphones in an hour.
9 months ago, this was the best thing I could find on the market or being developed.
Then he put aside the poster-sized charger and showed me what looked like a camo napkin.
This is a 10-watt solar blanket. This weighs 3.8 ounces. So within 9 months, we went from what we thought was really, really, really good to a 28% efficient solar cell and reduced the size down to a third of what it was before.
REF just bought 2 kilowatts of these cells for $2 million. That's $100 per watt. It's way too expensive for normal use. But it's a tenth what the cells would have cost a year ago. And in another 2 years, the Silicon Valley company that makes them, Alta Devices, hopes to have the cost down to $10 a watt. Meanwhile, soldiers are going to be using these. And if they come to trust the solar mats, maybe some of those 27 pounds of batteries can stay back at the base. For all the technological wonders, REF's social tech impressed me most. The fuel-eating combat outposts I mentioned earlier, REF is prototyping a radical redesign. They put one up at a gunnery range by Fort Bliss, Texas, and got 2 dozen soldiers to live in it for 2 weeks.
Independent, self-sustaining.
And then in February, REF hired a leading Silicon Valley marketing firm, IDEO, to run a 3-day exercise to try to understand what the soldiers had learned, what they might change. It's the kind of thing very big tech firms do because it works. REF thinks of the soldier as the customer. And among the changes the soldier suggested, an emergency intercom system for these outposts. And REF is working on it.
Soldier while calling for help if he's by himself.
REF directors, Colonel Newell and those before him, spend a lot of time with high-tech firms and venture capitalists, and they're at the best engineering and business schools trying to understand how to be very, very agile.
Stop trying to solve the problem. Spend your time trying to understand what it is you're supposed to be doing. The problem will eventually solve itself.
Colonel Newell leaves his post at REF this week. He's retiring from the Army. The Department of Defense has just decided to change REF's status from interesting experiment to permanent agency. We'll see how that works. But I was in the Army a long time ago, and even at Fort Bliss for a while. And it definitely was not this smart. From Bern, this is Alex Chadwick for Marketplace.
Alex Chadwick is the host of Bern, an energy journal from Sound Vision Productions, with support from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation. We've got a slideshow of that new combat outpost Alex was talking about. It's at marketplace.org. Here's something I did not see coming from a credit card company. Chase is launching a new online initiative called the Resource Center for Mindful Spending. Yes, mindful spending, not careless or profligate or extravagant, mindful. Chase says it wants to help customers take steps towards a better financial future at a time when most consumers tell them their personal finances are either the same or getting better. Michael D'Antonio is the co-author of Spend Shift. Mr. D'Antonio, thanks for joining us.
It's great to be with you.
How skeptical should we be of this mindful spending program coming from a credit card company? Isn't it their job to get us to spend more?
Well, I think they may see their job as getting us to trust them first. And there is a feeling abroad, I think, of consumption driven by ideas beyond getting and having. So I guess if I were a credit card company or a financial institution, I'd be wanting first to connect with my customers, and this is a great way to connect to them.
Now, the Chase website uses this term, mindful spending, and people throw that term around a lot. What does it mean to you?
To me, it means almost going back to the time when people paid with cash. You know, when you had a wad of bills in your pocket, if you're lucky enough to have a wad of bills in your pocket, you could feel it getting smaller.
Right.
And I think that it's a way to reduce your own anxiety. You know, information is a great cure. I think it's better than Xanax.
Now, Chase says that 39% of us are spending the same or more than we did pre-recession. But, of course, that means that 61% of us are spending less. How do you read those numbers? What do you read into them?
I think they're very accurate. I think that people are taking pride in spending less. One of the things that we've discovered is there's a lot of pride in repair now and do-it-yourself activities. It's a great pleasure to be able to extend the life of something that you paid good money for.
But let me ask you this. Do you think that our age of hyper-consumerism is really over, or is it just that we've got post-recession fatigue, and once this all goes away, we're just going to go back to business as usual?
You know, I want to believe that the hyper-consumerism is on the wane. And one reason why I think it might be is this is most keenly felt among the youngest generation of adults. So maybe as the baby boomers go into retirement and live within their means, there'll be several generations of folks taking pride in living with less and feeling really, really good about it.
Yeah. I guess the flip side of that, though, Michael, is that a lot of those young people are, you know, they're being forced into this sort of frugality. They just, you know, they're not getting good jobs. They're either unemployed or underemployed.
I'm very much aware of that, you know, being the father of two people under 30 who are underemployed. And I don't think this is a happy thing. But there's a natural inclination in all of us to explain our lives in a way that makes it possible for us to be happy. So some of this is taking pride in what you can do.
Michael D'Antonio is the author of Spendshift and most recently The Athena Doctrine. Michael, thanks so much.
So good to be with you. Thank you.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
And finally, you know that big immigration bill they're working on in Congress? Well, the bigger the bill, the easier it is to stuff with pork. Among the pet provisions you can find buried in that 844 pages of legislation, more visas for foreign workers in the American meat industry. That was Senator Lindsey Graham, South Carolina. New York Senator Chuck Schumer's put in for an extra 10,500 visas for Irish workers. And Senator Michael Bennett of Colorado threw in a provision making it easier to hire more foreign ski instructors. No joke. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow added 19 points, 0.1%. The NASDAQ gained 27 points, 0.8%. And the S&P 500 rose 7 points, 0.5%. Our producers include Bridget Bodner, Gina Delvac, Mary Dew, Nancy Fargali, Millie Jefferson, John Ketchum, Jolie Myers, and Chow Tu. I'm Sarah Gardner. See you tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.